Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is Scott Samuelson, author of The Deepest Human Life, An Introduction to Philosophy for Everyone. In it, Samuelson writes,
"We're human, all too human, thank God. We have serious limits, not just in evolutionary history and all the brute facts of the body, but our ignorance of the ultimate truths as well. We also have the capacity to wield earth-shattering, heaven-opening powers, and without some kind of harnessing of those energies into the goods of spirit and mind, our days and nights are either wicked or drab affairs. Philosophy is the story of humanely realizing our humanity, of making an honest living with both our transcendence and our ignorance, of taking seriously those words engraved on the temple of Apollo, Gnothi se auton, know thyself."
Samuelson will be joining us in Memphis on January 15th at 6 p.m. for a free public lecture across the street from Rhodes College at Evergreen Presbyterian Church titled Suffering and Soulmaking on the Deep Value of the Liberal Arts. Today on Counterpoint, we dig into the deepest human life. Scott Samuelson, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on, Jonathan.
Scott, why this book? What's the mode of philosophy that you were reacting against?
I guess my goal in writing the book was to open the doors of philosophy as wide as I could. I stand with folks like Socrates and the Stoics and Kant, and thinking that philosophy is really valuable for everyone. So I wanted to write a book that wasn't dumbed down in any way, that was still accessible and engaging. The subtitle is An Introduction to Philosophy for Everyone, and I guess that most of the time when people hear that subtitle, they think, well, meaning philosophy for, you know, people outside the academy, and that's definitely true, but I want there to be a little naughtiness in the subtitle as well, that it's not just people outside the academy who could use an introduction to philosophy. Sometimes even philosophers could use a reintroduction to their subject. So I guess, in other words, I'm reacting to a tendency in philosophy to become cut off from how we live our lives. Sometimes philosophy, both how it's written and how it's taught, philosophy can seem like some giant intellectual jigsaw puzzle, like you're trying to put together a million pieces so they look just like the world, or else you're just criticizing how someone else has put together the puzzle. But in my view, philosophy isn't really a jigsaw puzzle, or that's only at best one little moment of it. The questions that philosophy explores are the questions that we have to deal with, and not just in the classroom, but outside the classroom. They're questions that really matter for how we live our lives. So I guess in writing the book, I wanted to return philosophy to Socrates, so to speak, to trying to live the examined life.
So say a little bit more about academic philosophy and the way in which it's currently practiced, and how your book is a little bit different from that in the sense that it's really about the art of living. It's about the art of living well.
I think that a lot of times philosophy is practiced in academia as mainly being a very highly theoretical subject. And there definitely is a theoretical component to philosophy, and I don't mean to disparage a lot of what goes on in academic philosophy, because I think a lot of it is really exciting and important and good. But there is always a danger that lurks there that somehow it will lose touch with the deeper aspects of philosophy, which I really do think, as you say, are more about how we live our lives, a kind of practice, so to speak. So I really think of philosophy as a practice first and a theory second. And in fact, in some ways, I find it odd that so many people, even including philosophers, will think of philosophy as the construction of just some big perfect theory that accounts for everything. Because if you think of philosophy that way, philosophy comes off as being a pretty big flop, you know, a kind of bargain bin version of science, because philosophers are always disagreeing, and not just about their theories, but even about like their methods or what even constitutes philosophy. But if you think of philosophy as a practice, then it starts to make a lot more sense. It's trying to lead the examined life. So yes, you have to kind of step back from life and think about it. But at the same time, you got to go out there and live. So you've got to live in relation to those big ideas that you're thinking about in philosophy.
So I guess part of what you're reacting against, I mean, in terms of using this analogy of the jigsaw puzzle, is this effort to try and create some theory that is a whole coherent picture of reality. In part, it seems to me that maybe a good analogy for what you're doing is using the painter's array of colors. That is, you are pulling from lots of different kinds of theories in order to advocate for different uses that allow people to have some tools of analysis and insight, certain kinds of practices that allow them to paint their own picture of themselves, know thyself.
That's a really nice way of putting it. I guess I'm sort of a philosophical pluralist, that I feel like if, you know, everyone had to agree with Kant, or everyone had to agree with Nietzsche, or everyone had to agree with Plato, or everyone had to agree with Aristotle, that somehow our overall sense of truth would be diminished. That, as you say, you know, one explores these people who are themselves trying to live lives and work things out and think about their culture and what it's doing. and we can learn a lot from them, obviously. But yeah, I think ultimately we have to engage in that process for ourselves. And that's what I find so wonderful about philosophy. Like I said, it's not just indoctrinating people into a theory, but trying to initiate them into this practice.
So let's elaborate on that just a little bit, because if wisdom isn't providing a wholesale coherent account of reality, you suggest at one point that it's a style. You say wisdom isn't a doctrine, it's a style. So I want to know a little bit more about you now as the artist, if you will, drawing on this palette of different theories. Let's talk about your style. Of course, the heart of the book is an explication of some of the great philosophers. But you tell anecdotes from films, you drop quotes from literature, and not just from the Western tradition, but from global sources. Tell us a little bit about how you read, when you read, what you read, where do you come across this stuff, and then how does it really get integrated into your overarching vision of wisdom? Tell us a little bit, in other words, about how you've developed your style.
I'm really glad that you ask about style, because to me, style really is central to philosophy. I know that a lot of people think of style as being something secondary or merely ornamental. I guess for them, there's the substance of what you're saying, and then there's how you express it. But for me, I really think of style as being inseparable from philosophy itself, or I suppose even from being human. I can get to some of my reading habits, but let me explain what I mean, because I think that that's, for me, very important. You know, I teach a wide variety of students, including students who are living with a terminal illness, or students who have just come back from war, students who have just lost loved ones. Once I was giving a lecture on how the Stoics, great group of ancient Greek philosophers, believe that you can maintain your dignity and freedom even while being tortured, even in prison. And I looked up to see a student of mine in tears. She was a refugee from Sudan, and I remembered that her sister was put in prison by religious zealots. And for all she knew, for all my student knew, her sister was being tortured while I was lecturing about what the Stoics have to say about what you do in prison while you're being tortured. I've tried to develop a style of teaching and writing that speaks to her. I don't know if I'm successful or not, but that seems to me really important and part of what philosophy is about. So I always think to myself, well, how do you talk to someone wrestling, you know, with the big issues of being alive? How do you talk to my student when she's thinking of her sister? How do I talk to a student when that student is suffering from a terminal illness? I feel like you shouldn't just talk as if you're some high and mighty know-it-all, or you don't necessarily show off. You don't try to get lost in all the piddly little details, but you do try to be honest. You try to offer the best of what you know. You try to be yourself. You try to tell meaningful stories. I don't even think there's anything wrong with telling a joke now and again. You know, so you look around from wherever you can to find words up to that task. And so for me, like that trying to speak in that way, that is the philosophy, or that the style of it is important or inseparable from the content of what's being said.
Let me just say a word about that, because actually this is the way that I read your subtitle, An Introduction to Philosophy for Everyone. It's really, you're developing a voice that translates oftentimes very abstruse ideas into a way that make plain why it ought to matter to everyone. Obviously people beyond the academy, but also again, a reminder to we academics about what it is that we're teaching in terms of how it does connect up the Stoics and the real experience of people who may be going through a family member who's gone through torture or someone who has to deal with another tragic aspect of life. So that is how I understood your voice. In other words, that's just another way of saying your style in the book.
Yeah, right. And I think it's important to remember that it's not just, you know, a few people who are wrestling with the big issues. We're all wrestling with them. I mean, you know, we're all terminal cases, after all. We're all connected to people suffering from injustice at some level. Life and death and suffering and all the big things that philosophy and the liberal arts more generally deal with are the very things that you and me and your listeners right now, we're all dealing with. You know, so yeah, I tried to find a language that's, you know, alive to that. I don't know how successful I am, but I'm glad to hear that you feel like that it comes across at least to some degree.
Part of that is that that language isn't only found in conventional philosophy. It's found in films, it's found in literature, it's found in a whole number of different sources. And I think the art of the book is that you've brought them together in a very elegant way. Let's get a sense of the book as a whole before we discuss some of the parts. Tell us about why you set the book up the way that you do. How is it structured and why did you structure it that way?
I guess I'm trying to kill lots of birds with one stone, or lots of birds with one book, so to speak. I wanted to give people a sense of some of the major figures throughout the whole history of philosophy. I also wanted to give a kind of thematic introduction to philosophy. I also wanted to show how philosophy has made contact with polytheism, with Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and even atheism. but kind of most of all, I wanted to tell a story of what philosophy is all about. So I was trying to do kind of all of those things, so to speak, simultaneously. The way I divide up the book is into four parts. I guess this is sort of the thematic arrangement of the book, but there's also a historical unfolding. The first part is called What is Philosophy? And there I focus mainly on the figure of Socrates himself, who is sort of one of my heroes and really the hero of Western philosophy, someone who not only talked the talk of philosophy, but walked the walk of it. And then in the second section, it's called What is Happiness? And there I look at ancient philosophies of what the Greeks called eudaimonia, which gets translated as happiness, but really means something even broader than that, this sense of living a meaningful, full life overall throughout your life. And so after Socrates, the Greek and Roman philosophers were very focused on this question of the pursuit of happiness, and philosophy was very much the art of trying to find it. The third section is called, Is Knowledge of God Possible? And I look at a great medieval Muslim thinker, Al-Ghazali, a great kind of mystical Sufi thinker. Then I also look at kind of one of the fathers of modern philosophy, René Descartes, great rationalist thinker. And then I look at also the philosopher Blaise Pascal, who kind of splits the difference in some ways, I suppose, between Al-Ghazali and Descartes. And then in the fourth section, it's called What is the Nature of Good and Evil? And there I look at what Kant has to say about questions of morality and also what some various contemporary philosophers have to say, particularly about the issues that deal with evil. Hans Jonas and Hannah Arendt, two philosophers who I think great philosophers, but also had to confront the Holocaust.
Now, when you address the question, what is happiness or what is human fulfillment, as you've said, is maybe a better way of translating what you're getting after, you sum up the teaching of the Epicurean philosophers by telling us what it's like for you working at a little French restaurant in the Iowa countryside called Simone's Plain and Simple. So you work there, I guess, moonlighting from time to time. And the restaurant and what happens there perfectly encapsulates what the teaching of Epicurus aimed at. Tell us about your moonlighting at Simone's Plain and Simple and why it does illuminate Epicurus.
Yeah, and I mean, as I'm kind of going through the structure that I just tried to lay out, I do try to integrate into it stories about how all these philosophers relate to people's lives. And so, yeah, I think of Simone as being my kind of beautiful Epicurean. Simone herself, who runs Simone's Plain and Simple, she's from France, and she taught French literature at the University of Iowa for some time. And she retired a little bit on the early side and devoted herself to this farmhouse that she had and its fairly extensive gardens. She opened up this really lovely little restaurant there that catered to parties of about, 15 to 25 people usually, though not always groups of friends and family. And about a decade ago, we really hit it off, Simone and I. And when she found out that I was a fairly serious cook, she invited me to help her out at a restaurant, and I happily agreed. Things went fairly well. So I've been her sous chef for quite some time now. She's almost retired, I should say, so I don't get to do it as much as I once did, but she'll sometimes still fire up her brick oven for a party and I'll help out. But anyway, Epicurus's philosophy is centered on finding what we most basically desire as human beings and scaling back our lives to those primary things, things like friendship, good food, contact with the cycles of nature, meaningful work. In the American tradition, I think of Thoreau as having a bit of an Epicurean streak. But I myself much prefer Simone's model of Epicureanism to Thoreau's. Thoreau, great as he is a bit too solitary for me. Even when Simone isn't having guests over to her house, she has friends over to help her in her gardens, to eat with her, to sit and talk. But in a lot of ways, there is a Thoreau-like quality to her. She lives close to nature. She grows a lot of her own fruits and vegetables. She bakes her own bread and so on. And when I work with her, you know, it's actually very hard work. You got to pick the food, you got to do a lot of cooking, serving, cleaning, and all that stuff. But it really feels great. You feel really alive. See nature and culture blend really beautifully together. Her restaurant is called Simone's Plain and Simple. That sense of getting back to the plain and simple, to the well-made French food, to friends, to family, to water, wine, fireflies, the countryside. And she doesn't go to any crazy extremes in any one direction. But anyway, that sense of getting back to the plain and simple, that's to me very Epicurean. And she sort of embodies that, or she shows what that practice of the search for happiness really looks like. And when people see it, they almost always recognize it as a really beautiful thing.
And I remember, as you described it, one of her Epicurean approaches is, unlike most French cooking, there are not a lot of sauces. She's really trying to cultivate the natural flavors of the food. And that itself is a kind of mini metaphor for what the Epicureans were all about in terms of leading a life of happiness. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking with Scott Samuelson about his book, The Deepest Human Life, An Introduction to Philosophy for Everyone, in anticipation of his visit to Memphis on January 15th. In the section, Scott, on Is Knowledge of God Possible, you have three chapters, as you said, one on the Muslim philosopher Al-Ghazali, on Descartes, on Blaise Pascal, in other words, on mysticism, rationalism, and skepticism. So tell us a little bit about what you explore in these chapters, but then explain what you mean when you write, throughout the preceding chapters, I've been trying to propose what could be winkingly called a pragmatic mysticism. What do you mean by pragmatic mysticism, and how does it relate to these thinkers?
As you say, I ultimately characterize sort of the end of the philosophical journey as a kind of pragmatic mysticism. And I guess what I mean is that, well, philosophy begins in wonder, and it often leads us to kind of grand theories, but oftentimes those grand theories fall apart and they lead us to a kind of skepticism. But then we realize, well, we still have to lead our lives. And so we're now, hopefully at its best, philosophy opens us to experience. Almost in a mystical sense, we get to experience those things that really give meaning and value to our lives, justice, love, beauty, God. So I guess that's, to me, the mysticism part. And someone like Al-Ghazali really powerfully embodies this, where he goes on this huge journey and it leads to a great skeptical crisis. And then he eventually engages in this kind of religious practice associated with Sufism, and that brings him to this very deep experience of God, you know, that in a way goes beyond what reason can tell us, but nonetheless he recognizes as being valuable. But then we also, after the mysticism part, we still have to find beliefs and practices that make sense, that keep us in touch with those values, and that sort of work for us, that allow us to live decent lives or that open us up to the best parts of who we are. And to me, I guess that's the pragmatism part. You see that in someone like Pascal, I suppose, really interestingly. I mean, he too, as you characterize him, is kind of skeptic, and it's true with regard to God. He sort of says, well, we can't ever know rationally whether God exists or not, but he thinks that we have to take a gamble with our lives one way or the other. And his philosophy, I see, as being someone who's trying to take very seriously what it would mean to take that gamble. So I think of that as the sort of pragmatism part.
Scott, I mentioned earlier that you lace the book, and you've talked about how you lace the book with stories of your students. One that you tell is about a mother who'd authorized a risky surgery for her crippled son that led to his death, who came and asked you with tears in her eyes, is Kant right that the consequences of an action play no role in its moral worth? Tell us that story and how it illuminated Kant's moral philosophy.
I was teaching Kant and his idea that moral worth is located in the motive of our actions, and that the consequences of our actions play no role in their true worth. You might think about here the spirit of our Good Samaritan laws, where if you're trying to save someone's life through giving them CPR and you accidentally injure them or even kill them, you're not held legally culpable. And Kant has a sort of similar idea, even morally speaking, that we should just focus on the motive of the action rather than the consequences. Anyway, after I was teaching this, this middle-aged student came up to me after class and asked me, as you say, with tears in her eyes, you know, is Kant right about that? Is it true that the consequences play no role in the moral worth of an action? And, you know, I used the kind of ancient irritating teacher's dodge of saying, well, what do you think about that? And in response, she told me the story of how her son fell down a bunch of stairs. In fact, maybe was even pushed down by her ex-husband. And he was crippled and in a lot of pain. And there was a kind of risky surgery that was potentially helpful to him. And she had to decide whether or not to authorize it. And she eventually did authorize it, thinking it was the right thing to do for her son. And it ended up, as you say, leading inadvertently to his death. Of course, this was devastating for her, and of course, devastating so far as she lost her son, but also devastating insofar as what she did somehow led to her son's death. And when she told me that story, I did respond by saying, I really actually think that Kant is right about it, that maybe I didn't know that before, but after hearing your story, I really do believe that Kant's right. How does her story illuminate Kant's moral philosophy? Well, I guess, first of all, I saw just how important what Kant was saying was. Kant can often seem like that giant jigsaw puzzle version of philosophy, but, you know, I think he's more fruitfully approached by seeing him as really wrestling with those most basic questions, and he himself saw him, you know, that's what he was doing in his moral philosophy. But moreover, I guess I realized, you know, how Kantian I am, that when we think about controlling consequences, we're acting like we're gods, like we can control everything. And Kant's point is that we're humans, and all we can properly control is what we try to do. And our worth as humans involves struggling to live within ourselves, to do what's right, but also to live, I guess, within this tragic world where we don't control what happens. Stories like my students are all too common.
How is it that you're going to respond to the consequentialist who comes along and says, that's just a morally vacuous notion? Because what really counts is the ways in which the kinds of moral choices that we have ends up having an impact on the world. Now, I understand that what I'm getting into is sort of debating two different versions of jigsaw puzzles, but you can't build a picture of the world if you don't have all of the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, if we continue to use that analogy. So what do you do with that kind of response when you get it from philosophers wedded to exactly the opposite moral paradigm than Kant's? Those who say consequences are what matter, not our intentions.
Well, you're right. And of course, you know, in the classroom, I really do try to entertain those possibilities. It's the consequentialist view, the idea that we really should aim at bringing about the best consequences overall and that we should be judged accordingly. I mean, that is a powerful idea, and I don't mean to totally diminish it. You're right, I do not agree with it ultimately, and it is important to debate these kinds of jigsaw puzzle views, to use our metaphor, because, like I said, they do relate to these questions. But again, to me, I guess the important thing is that ultimately we're going to judge these things not so much purely on, you know, if they theoretically work out, because, you know, that will be an endless argument, an important one. I don't want to, you know, shut it down, but we ultimately are going to judge them by stories like my students, like, well, what happens, you know, when the rubber meets the road and we have to apply these to our lives? And for me, just to make a long story short, I really feel like it's important always to maintain that sense of our humanity. And I feel like that's what Kant's trying to do, is to maintain our sense of humanity. I worry, like I said, about the consequentialist view, that it makes us a bit into gods, or at least it sort of portrays us as if we are gods. And that's, of course, great when we can make everything work out how we want. But as soon as it doesn't work out how we want, do we really want to be judged, you know, on that? Or should we, usually at that point, we retreat and say, hey, I was trying to do the best I could. And that seems to me to be really where the moral worth lies, and that's where we should really focus.
Now, in the chapter on the nature of good and evil, you end up with part of the power of the book is you do a lot of storytelling. And I think that's very interesting as a presentation of philosophy. So you end up with one of my favorite stories told by the Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel, who recounts a tale of a group of prisoners who put God on trial in Auschwitz, the archetypal killing center during the Holocaust. Tell us Wiesel's tale, and then tell us about the questions that it puts on the table about the nature of good and evil that you explore at the end of the book.
Though it's somewhat unclear exactly what happened, Elie Wiesel sort of comes back to this again and again in his writings. It seems that at some point he, as a teenager at Auschwitz, witnessed a group of Jewish scholars convening this rabbinic court of law where they indicted and tried God for having abandoned them. The scholars presented careful arguments on each side, deliberated carefully, but in the end, the verdict was guilty. And at the time, evening is coming on, and it seems, after a long silence, an old scholar of the Talmud, who was part of this trial, finally said, it's time. And then they all join in saying the evening prayer. It's a haunting story, and it raises, obviously, really big questions. I suppose the most obvious one is the old question that we in philosophy call the problem of evil. The problem of, is it possible to reconcile a belief in an all-good, all-powerful God with the existence of such unjust suffering in the universe? But the story, to me, raises a new version, you could say, of the problem of evil, or a newer version of the problem of evil, one that pertains not just to God, but to humanity, you know, because the suffering of Auschwitz, after all, was inflicted not directly by God, but by humans. In fact, in Auschwitz or Hiroshima, what we humans did outstripped any tornado or hurricane or cancer, the kind of destructiveness that we sometimes refer to as an act of God. So, you know, the question is not just can we believe in God in light of terrible, unjust suffering of the universe, but can we even believe in humanity? This, I guess, is related to the question of can we believe in God, but, you know, was God or nature right in generating us? Was the sixth day of creation really worth it? Would the world be better without, you know, humanity that inflicts things like Auschwitz? What I love most about that story from Elie Wiesel is that the scholars are intellectually honest in their deliberations, and yet they ultimately refuse to give up faith that there is something worth it to being human, that ultimately they somehow remain committed to their practices.
And the practices, I mean, from a Jewish perspective, in some senses, the practices are the very mechanism by which we come to dance with God in her absence or his absence. So just to kind of bring things to a close, Scott, you published a piece in The Atlantic with the absolutely fabulous title, Why I Teach Plato to Plumbers. The subtitle of that piece is Liberal Arts and the Humanities Aren't Just for the Elite. Why do plumbers need Thoreau or Beethoven or Plato or Al-Ghazali?
Well, because they're not just plumbers. They're also people embarked on the journey of being human. They're just as much on that journey as doctors and lawyers and professors. And Beethoven and Plato are incredibly helpful in that regard. You know, when you have plenty of money, you usually intuitively see why a liberal arts education is important. You tend to send your kids to schools that cultivate the liberal arts. I suppose because the liberal arts helps you to think for yourself, to be a decision maker. They help code you as someone with power. And moreover, they're just really good. We want our kids to be exposed to the best of the human inheritance. I don't see why working class citizens of a democracy shouldn't also get in on that act. The title of my book comes from a line from William James, "The deepest human life is everywhere." I don't know about your plumber, but my plumber's a really interesting person.
I guess I want to push that just a little bit further, though. Oftentimes, the way in which the canon out of which you are pulling many of your references, yes, you go well beyond just the Western canon, but they're still key central figures. Why is it that these are the works that you see as embodying the best and most significant, most insightful, the kinds of articulations that do lead to the deepest human life? Why those sorts of works as opposed to other kinds of things? Can't it all lead to the same place in the end?
Well, I mean, it probably does up to a point. I just find that with the great works of the philosophical tradition that I just don't know of anything better than those works to speaking to people. I mean, I'm certainly always open to hearing other possibilities. But for me, someone like a Plato or an Epicurus or an Epictetus or a Kant, they articulate things so powerfully, and they're the kinds of things you can come back to again and again and always draw illumination from. To me, this is like I said, just the best I have. But you're certainly right that there's a lot of different roads that can lead us to these places, and I try to weave in other things that help to illuminate these great ideas. But for me, these are the ideas that I myself just keep coming back to again and again, and it's the best I have to offer.
And at least if the tradition says anything, it is the best that we have to offer. That's part of what ends up constituting the canon, even as it gets remade and reworked out in terms of the kinds of questions that we're dealing with. Scott Samuelson, thank you so much for being with us today on Counterpoint to discuss The Deepest Human Life, An Introduction to Philosophy.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
You've really helped us to understand that the discipline is for anyone interested in living well or really the practice of those leading the deepest human life. Scott Samuelson will be in Memphis on January 15th at 6 p.m. to give a free public lecture titled Suffering and Soulmaking at Evergreen Presbyterian Church across the street from Rhodes College. Join us. Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to the show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you will find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.